Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Rachel Graham, the founder of Mara Alliance.
Hello, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you today.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I am super excited to hear about yourself, your organization, and the amazing work that you guys have been doing. Can you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and how did you first become interested in conservation?
That's a wonderful step back in time. Was absolutely fascinated. I'm a really curious person, and I was just absolutely fascinated by wildlife from a very young age. But interestingly enough, at least from my point of view, interested in a lot of marginalized or kind of reviled species. So the bats, the snakes, and indeed the sharks of the world. And that kind of set me on this path of really trying to find out a lot more about them, but also trying to understand why people really dislike them as much as they do. And now what's wonderful is they're all having their moment in the sun as people recognize that they're incredibly important to the health of our planet.
No, that is fantastic. I think a lot of times media comes into play with our perception of a lot of species and the way that they're kind of marketed to us as something that could be dangerous or vicious or ferocious, and you kind of view it that way and you see it in a certain angle. So it's exciting to see that you kind of wanted to challenge that and expand people's learning around these species. How would you best describe what Mara Alliance is to everyone listening here today?
So in response to seeing a lot of species populations declining, especially in the sea, I've been working nearly 30 years in the seas, and especially with sharks and rays and other large fish, kind of slow life history fish, where they take a long time to reach maturity, sometimes 10, 20, even 100 years, and they have very few young. I'm just seeing these declines, and it became really urgent to do something about it. And that's why I created Mara Alliance. I have been working in the conservation and academic space for marine science and conservation for nearly 30 years, but I felt that there was definitely a need and space for an international organization that was nimble, that could really broach these topics, try and restore these declining populations, effectively rewild the seas with a lot of these threatened species, especially sharks and rays, and connect people to the ocean and to these species whilst doing so. And I wanted an organization that really has connection and engagement at the grassroots levels in the tropical countries where we work. And I hadn't really seen that, especially working with sharks and rays. So I created Mara Alliance. It was my approach. I created it in 98, and then I created Mara Alliance in 2014. And I haven't looked back a day since, and we've grown, and we work with a multitude of communities and species in several different tropical countries.
That's incredible what your passion for these species has achieved. Is Mara Alliance something that you started completely independently, or was it a group effort? Did you have help and support in building of the organization?
So I founded Mara Alliance, but its conservation is not a singular endeavor. So I really credit my founding board with helping get us going. I had an incredible team of scientists and traditional fisher partners. And then I had donors who really, really believed in what we wanted to do, what we were doing already, and what we planned on doing, what our big vision and goals were. And one of those is our incredible partner, the Wildlife Conservation Network, who just champions these smaller organizations and puts them in front of donors and gives them a platform to talk about their work and their organization, very much like what we're doing right now.
Yes, that is exactly why I decided to partner with the Wildlife Conservation Network to bring them and their NGO partners onto the show to expand people's learning and understanding of this incredible work that goes on that I don't feel gets the sort of applause and platforms that it deserves, because it often gets overshone by a lot of negative climate rhetoric. And I'm really thankful that I'm able to give this space and for the connections with both yourself and the WCN. With that being said, I would love to kind of dive into what are the most pressing threats, from your opinion, would you say, are faced by marine wildlife today? And how is your organization actively working to address these?
So since we work with fish, fishers, fisheries, first and foremost, and sharks and rays form part of that, as well as some of these longer lived and threatened fish species, overfishing is by far the biggest threat to these species and these populations. It's a direct threat and one that doesn't seem to be abating. And these slow-growing species, just to give you an idea, for example, a lot of these larger-bodied sharks, they take 10, 15, 20 years to reach maturity, and they'll only have a few pups, and only, you know, a small percentage of those pups will actually survive to adulthood to be able to reproduce. And it's the same thing with some of these fish. You know, you think a snapper on your plate, you don't give it a second thought. But some of these snappers, as our team has discovered, are 60, 70 or more years old. And so they cannot keep up with the impact of overfishing. So I'd say that's a first and most important threat. But right on its heels, we also have the loss of their habitats through coastal development. So a lot of unregulated coastal development that are ripping out a lot of their key habitats, or what we call critical habitats, where they grow up, where they find their food, where they might reproduce as well. And that's a major problem. And of course, we cannot avoid climate change. And I think it's really important to note that climate change is changing our seas in ways that are quite dramatic. Not only increasing the temperature of our seas, but by taking in all that carbon dioxide, the excess carbon dioxide, it's also changing the chemistry of our seas. So literally, our seas are becoming more acidic. And as a result, many species at the bottom of the food chain that all these fish are reliant on cannot necessarily form their body shells anymore. These invertebrates are struggling to actually grow. And some of the habitats, like coral reefs, are also struggling to accrete or build because the acidic environment is counter to their growth. So those are, I would say, overfishing, loss of habitats, and climate change are kind of the axis of evil against fish. And of course, that impacts all the many coastal communities and many more who are dependent on them.
Yeah, they're being targeted from every side there is. And I feel like even the stuff that you evaded there in terms of the amount of pollution that goes into our oceans, the breakdown of microplastics that's having effects on ocean and marine life as well, it honestly does put a lot of things into perspective, particularly when you mention about the understandings of the growth rates of particular sharks and the juveniles, and what actually is the age of the fish that's ended up on your plate, and how much are we affecting their natural life cycles when it comes to particularly our cuisine, our food, our demand for this food. Could you share some success stories on how this scientific research has led to positive outcomes in marine wildlife conservation? Because finding out these things is great. Okay, we now know that these sharks can live up to 100 plus years. But what can we then do with that information that's now helping and aiding marine conservation?
So I definitely want to talk about the conservation successes, because there are definitely quite a few, and they are growing. It's not a wave of them. But I do want to touch on a couple more things to do with threats.
Absolutely. Go for it.
If I may. So pollution is a key threat. Of course, microplastics, it's a disaster. Every time I open up a fish and I'm doing a you know, I'm doing a review of the organs or the gonads to check on its reproductive state, etc., I'm usually finding pieces of plastic in the fish. Yes, and that's pretty shocking. And while I'm doing these things, I'm also sharing that with fishers I work with and with students and community members, because I think it's really important that everybody recognize how to do the science that we do to be able to understand and monitor these fish. And that brings me to another point, which is the lack of understanding of fish and the lack of concern for them. We have a whole repertoire of vocabulary just for fish and fishing. We even use the word harvesting for fish. You don't harvest cows. You do not harvest chickens, and yet you're okay to harvest fish. And people consider that fish are, they're cold, they're unthinking, they're not very smart, and all of these types of things. But they
do
really...
Do you think this is because often communities are so far removed from the ocean and the visibility of the depths of the ocean, kind of the deeper impacts of that? Because, for example, I'm here based in London. We're very city-based. We have the Thames that runs through. But aside from that, we're quite far away from coastal living or coastal knowledge in that sense. And our demand, our mindset are very much based on the societies that we kind of grew up in. So, for example, I worked in sea turtle conservation in Greece when I was at university. And the mindset and the way that they looked at the ocean and the way that they fished or the communities lived around it was so vastly different from those even in cities in the same country. So do you think that plays into this in terms of knowledge and education?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you do not have a connection with nature or a connection with the sea and understand really where your food is coming from, especially your seafood, then it will not be appreciated for all the incredible characteristics that those animals have. And this is also a big conundrum, and this segues into the conundrum that we have compared to many other wildlife conservationists out there. And that is that many of the species that we're really trying to conserve are also food for over 500 million people on the planet. Fish and fisheries are sustaining 3 out of the 8 billion on our planet. There's that many people who are involved in either aquaculture or direct fisheries or the processing or, you know, from the small scale fisher with the hook and line all the way up to the large trawlers. So it's a conundrum, and that is also, it's a threat and it's an opportunity. A threat in the way that there is this dissociation with the sea and these species and this lack of connection with them and understanding of them. And that is something that we work on actively to really build those connections. And that's where the opportunity lies, is that we have the opportunity to engage people, get them excited about understanding these species better and doing the science that really motivates people to learn more about these animals. Like when I just mentioned, for example, the snapper on your plate may be 60 years old. Oh, my God. People will think very differently about an animal that might be the age of your grandfather.
That's a very, very good way to put it. I am so excited to continue to dive into all of this with you, but we're just going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at a special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Rachel, the founder of Mara Lights. We just left off on the topic of how the breadth of the ocean is so underappreciated by the vast majority of people that are actively affecting ocean life. And we just left off on the topic of the idea of a 70-year-old snapper on your dinner table, on your plate, and what is your connection and knowledge about knowing the history of this fish and the impacts that you are having by actively A, being part of this very, very complex food chain that does involve us, but then also involves the complexities of the hundreds of marine life and sea creatures that are interlinked into this system that we really have very limited information about as the general public. I am super excited for Rachel to continue telling us more about the complexities involved in the threat of marine life. And she's also going to jump into how some of the scientific research has led to positive outcomes for marine wildlife conservation.
I'm really, really happy that you actually brought up the aspect with the snapper, because in order to know how old they are, you need to conduct science. And this is part of what we do. We try to co-create science with the communities we are engaging and the decision makers and local students. Our big onus is working locally. There's, in the past, it used to be a lot of parachute science where people were coming from the north and doing their science in tropical countries and then leaving those countries without any installed capacities, without leaving data behind, and without actually influencing any conservation or policy. That has shifted dramatically, I'm very happy to say. And so through our local teams working with local communities, especially fishing communities, we co-create the science that is necessary for us to try and restore populations of threatened species of sharks, big fin fish, etc. And in doing so, that co-created science might involve everything from aging fish, where you actually have to take these little bony elements out of the fish's head called otoliths, and you cross-section them, and then you read the bands just like that of a tree. That's how you determine the age of a fish, and you can count back and you can determine how old that fish is. That is science that then, in a very gentle way, makes our partners think, oh my goodness, maybe this deep sea fishery that just opened up is not one that we should hit so hard. We might need to know more about it, and we might need to manage access to that fishery, or else it might be another case of boom and bust, which is what you see throughout fisheries, throughout the world, throughout history, everything from cod and more. So that is one of the success stories that I would like to bring to your listeners today, is that co-creation of science, be it determining the age and the growth of these fish, be it trying to find out whether certain species, like the very critically endangered sawfish, still exist in all of Central America. And we were able to determine that by using something called environmental DNA, where you literally are filtering water. And if the species you're looking for has shed some of its skin, in the case of sharks and rays, it's what's called dermal denticles, like little teeth on their skin, that can get picked up in the water that you filter. And you cross-check that with DNA from a sawfish, and you can say, yes, we still have that species here. And that can be done with these communities. So they see firsthand that they might have the only sites left for this critically endangered species, as determined by the overarching organization that determines how populations are doing of wildlife species. It's called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And this, for example, is how we helped combine with social surveys with community members and fishers throughout Central America. We helped determine and identify hotspots where large-toothed sawfish persist to this day, even though they have rarely been seen. And then that helps you to focus your conservation and focus your funding. We don't have much funding in our sector. It's a horrifically underfunded sector, but it helps us focus that. And then we determine what strategies to take to try and restore those populations. Again, co-creating those strategies with the people who depend on the species or the sites where they live. Hence, the coastal communities.
Incredible. You've touched base there on a lot of critical habitats for marine wildlife. Can you explain what these are to our listeners and why are they so important?
So I love to talk about critical habitats. Imagine a house, your house. I'm not going to sing the song, even though I absolutely love it. So imagine your house. In your house, you have your kitchen, your bedroom, your living room. And if you're not in a flat, you're actually in a house and you've got a garden, which kind of serves as a buffer between you and another house. And when you have a baby, where do you put the baby? Maybe in one of the bedrooms or the nursery. And that is kind of the focal hotspot area for that baby to grow up. That's where it will spend a large amount of its time until it's large enough to roam around to other areas in the house. That is a critical area for you to be in to grow up. And then as you get older, you then move out of the house. You're going to look for food in the supermarket. You're going to maybe a restaurant to find different type of food because you don't like just what's in the supermarket. And then you go and you might find your date and mate at an event or something like that. So these areas
I love this analogy that you've done. I've just built this whole society for this marine life in my head. I'm loving
it. Exactly. And that's exactly what it is. I'll give you an example. So hammerheads, we love hammerheads, 360 degree vision because of their eyes on the end of their head, which is called a cephalofoil. There's all kinds of fabulous facts to know about hammerheads. But they're very predictable in that they give birth in shallow areas, kind of shallow coastal areas primarily. Why? Because they want their pups, those are the young of sharks and rays, to be in these shallow, warm areas to grow up away from predators, preferably, and they will eat a certain type of food, etc. Same as babies in a house. They're mainly going to be in the house. And then at a certain age, they're able to leave the house, and then they'll discover a range of other habitats. But during that formative period, they have to be in a more protected surround and then move from there. That is probably one of the best descriptions of what a critical habitat might be from our perspective and that of, for example, a shark or any kind of fish. And as I said, you then, as you grow up, you have a different diet, you move to different areas, and then you might frequent the same restaurants time and time again, or you go and travel to France because you like from the UK to travel to France to your very special spot. Marine wildlife is exactly the same. And you get those odd folks who decide, well, I feel like going to Bali. And they'll head off to Bali. And sharks will do exactly the same thing. Yep. Fish will do. They'll do some, many will follow one pattern and that others will do something completely different. And it's wonderful to talk about them in the news as well because it just shows how diverse their behaviors are. And understanding that is also forms the basis of some of our conservation strategies, like the creation of marine protected areas. So imagine a marine protected area is indeed that house in the sea where you're trying to protect multiple habitats if you can, to try and also protect not only those critical areas, but also fish or sharks, rays, other marine wildlife species during key moments in their life history.
So you've mentioned some amazing work around critical habitat and protecting them, these protected marine areas. However, I wanted to know how climate change is impacting these critical habitats and how is MarAlliance working to ensure that there are further protected marine habitats for these crucial periods and the accessibility for multiple regions around the world to have these, because climate change is not happening localized to one region, it's a global issue.
So climate change is indeed the thorn in our side for a lot of marine protected areas, for marine conservation in general, and of course the world. When you establish a marine protected area, most of them are they're site-based. There are increasingly people are looking at establishing maybe mobile protected areas that follow a process or a current pattern, etc. But for most of these, protected areas are very much site-based, and those sites are changing with climate change. And what you're seeing is, as many of these are in coastal areas, those shallow coastal seas are getting hotter. So as they heat up, the impact that they can have in, for example, being a nursery site for many fish species is in danger, because many of these species don't necessarily have the volume to be able to withstand greater heat. It also means that they're going to have to work harder to have more oxygen to survive. So that's how climate change is really impacting some of these shallower coastal areas that are both critical habitats and might be included in a marine protected area. So doing the co-created science that we do with the communities and fishers helps us kind of identify what is using these areas. How are they doing over time? This is the whole point of monitoring. And as part of that, and that's why monitoring is so important. You need to know what you have as a baseline and measure it over time. And then you can...
Can I just interject real quick there? I wanted to know, with the basis of this information, what is the flexibility and adaptability that scientists are able to provide to these regions? So let's say that we're noticing that there is a slight increase in water temperature for this particular region, and it's going to affect, for example, egg laying or the ability for the fish to even come into that region because they follow a different temperature pattern and they don't feel like, oh, we shouldn't be going in this direction. What is the flexibility and adaptability that we are then able to provide to these regions to then lower the temperature or ensure that that region is still protected based off the research?
So lowering temperatures right now is a long game. So what we can do is try and expand the area under protected areas management, try to mitigate the threats to some of these species so they just become more resilient. And what do I mean by that? Is just reduce fishing effort. Overfishing is the major impact to marine wildlife and notably fish. And as you note, I'm calling them wildlife because they are. They're wildlife. So expanding these protected areas is potentially key and critical, but it has to be done with the people who are dependent on those areas. So what used to happen was there was this creation. We saw this a lot in Africa and Asia, especially the creation of protected areas on land where you create this protected area and you push the people out. We saw that to a certain degree in marine protected areas as well. And so there were quite a few backlashes or lack of engagement. And now it's very much work with the people dependent on those areas to see how you can protect them. And it's not necessarily a you don't fish at all here. It's how do you modulate your fishing to enable certain species to survive. And using the science that we do is establishing whether or not some of these species are still surviving with rising temperatures in coastal shorelines. They're using other areas so that we can, if we need to expand the protected area, then we can expand it to areas that cover more of their life history. So for example, in Belize, we were all shallow coastal areas. And then we were like, well, hang on a second. You know, many of these fish also use the deep drop-off after the coral reef. They'll go there. They'll spend some time in some of the deeper waters, 100, 200 meters. And then they'll come back up into the shallows So we need to make sure that we include that particular habitat in protected areas. So as Belize strives to meet what has been proposed by the United Nations as 30% of the seas protected by 2030, they've now expanded some of their protected areas into the deep sea, in part for that reason.
That, well, first of all, is incredible news. I kind of just want to jump back a bit to the work that Mar Alliance does with these dependent communities. Can you tell our listeners here how this directly contributes to marine conservation? And also, what have you learned through your history with working with these communities, these coastal communities?
So when I started my work almost 30 years ago, I had to decide where's the best way to be able to have the greatest impact and sustained impact for marine wildlife. And I saw a lot of folks focused on policy, which is great. You get these big international wins. It looks fabulous. It creates a structure and a framework within which we can work. But we are continuing to see decline after decline in all of the countries where we're working or we had been. And so looking much more closely at that, it's like, what's going on? There's more MPAs, marine protected areas being set up. There's more policies, more regulations, etc. And we're still seeing declines. So that's when I decided that even though it's very difficult to scale, working with communities of people on the front lines of these marine areas, the fishers, coastal communities, was going to be much more effective. And another reason why is because governments change. And, you know, marine might not be the flavor of the month for them when they change over. It might no longer be politically important or a priority. Whereas for the communities that depend on it, it always is. So working with these communities and not only building up their knowledge in how their ecosystems function and merging that with their traditional knowledge. And this is very important. A lot of people dismiss coastal communities and traditional fishers for not having any understanding. They don't get science. It's, no. They all have PhDs of the sea. So it's this beautiful merger of traditional and more kind of common orthodox science that is a really winning combination that then you take jointly to the decision makers, and you shape regulation and policy based on that. And that, we have seen, has actually led to successes from either the determination of where you establish a marine protected area to policies in protecting certain species. In Belize, for example, whale shark and nurse sharks, based on science, based on what the communities wanted. There's so many other aspects that we've seen as successes. And as a result, you're seeing changes in behavior and changes in consumer behavior. So people won't eat shark in certain areas where we work because we've done the science to show that there's a lot of methylmercury in sharks and it's actually bad for you. Choose something else that grows a lot faster that won't impact you as much. All of that is how we've worked with communities in Mar Alliance and how we will continue to work, connecting people with the sea, connecting people with marine wildlife, and co-creating not only the research, but the conservation action that's required for these long-term outcomes.
Amazing and beautifully said. And on that note, we'll be right back after this short break.
The station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional. Our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Rachel, founder of Mar Alliance. We just left off talking about coastal and ocean-dependent communities and the amazing work that they've been doing in conjunction with marine conservation, local learning, and from that, I really want to just like touch base into how do we balance the need of these coastal communities that really rely for their livelihoods on the ocean with the need to protect marine wildlife. From my perspective, a lot of the big global impacts when it comes to fishing isn't a result of these communities, it's a result of conglomerates stripping the oceans. And as a result of that, these local communities are also being deeply affected because, for example, they may be having been reliant on a specific fish species that they generally have fished for decades or generations that they now are seeing fewer of. And then that's then impacting multiple aspects of their lives and then could then contribute to knock-on effects in where they fish, how they fish, competitiveness in fishing. I'm sort of spiraling here at the moment, so I'm going to hand over the microphone to you.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm laughing because
yes,
this
is not a funny topic, but it's the reality. It's the reality for hundreds of thousands to millions of people around the world.
Yes, it is the reality. And it is a major conundrum for us when we're looking for conservation wins in the fish and fishery space, just because so many millions of people, you know, close to 500 million people are dependent on small scale fisheries and up to 3 billion people in the broader fisheries nexus around the world and seafood in general. So how do you try and protect what are many, many endangered, threatened species now? The International Union for the Conservation of Nature, for example, has just revised their numbers, and we're looking at about 37% of all sharks and rays. And we've got over 1,100 species, close to 1,200 actually, species are now endangered with extinction. So, and that's just the sharks and rays, the chondrichthyene, the cartilaginous fish, and there's a lot of teleosts or what we call finfish that are in very similar situations, not quite as threatened as the cartilaginous fish. So how do you balance the need to preserve these fish and the well-being of coastal communities? And that is that it's that delicate dance that we actually are in with many of the communities and our fisher partners at Mar Alliance. And that is trying to inform, educate, co-create the science to better understand the fish, to be more selective in the fishing as well. So by this, I mean there are gears that are much more sustainable in their use, and that would be like hook and line, for example, versus nets. Fishing nets are the walls of death of the sea. And if you ban or prohibit nets, at least in certain places or at certain times, or completely, like we managed to get done in Belize in 2020, you will see these animals coming back to the point where you actually can start catching them in a more sustainable way with hook and line. So it's really trying to work without castigating any fish and communities in a better understanding and working with them not only to transition to more sustainable fishing techniques where possible, and finding economic supplementation or alternatives during that transitionary period. And this is really important because you can't just say, stop using this, and then we're going to have to wait 5 or 6 years until those fish grow to maturity and reproduce. It's going to take a lot of years for that transition to occur. So people need to understand that economic supplementation or alternatives from sectors like tourism, where tourism is possible, or getting into construction or aquaculture or conservation. And this is where what we're trying to show and model is that conservation is a valid, it's not a hugely lucrative sector. We don't have a lot of money, but it
well,
is
we've got,
actually...
Well, we have to shift the perspective.
There we go.
Shift,
yeah. Absolutely. Because we literally are the nurses and doctors of the natural world. And we're raising the alarm and saying, we are monitoring the patients, the species and the habitats, and we're begging people to pay attention and to support the work. And this is critical. This is, and I want to say that this is critical because there's not enough of us out here. And this is why I really urge our younger generations to whom we want to pass the baton to join us it's challenging, but to join us in this field, because there is a lot of hope and we are seeing successes where we actually prohibit unsustainable fishing gears. We are seeing some of these species coming back. Sawfish, Caribbean reef sharks, nurse sharks, and more. Tuna. Tuna is the big story of the day. You're starting to see tuna coming back when you're putting in regulations, quotas, and you're limiting fisheries. So all of this is what we try to impart to the people we have the privilege of working with, traditional fishers and the coastal communities, and try to move forward together and find that balance between fishing and conservation.
There are going to be a lot of people listening today that have been moved by what you've said, or also have had a passion for marine wildlife and wildlife in general. And they may think to themselves, what is it that I can do? What is the everyday choice that they can make to reduce their impact on the ocean? What are some, for example, sustainable fishing practices that individuals can support? Or what sort of imperfect changes do you think that they can make in their everyday lives that could make positive global impact?
So I think one of the first things that I really ask people to do is just to be more mindful of what they eat. It starts with us. It used to be that you could only get seafood on the coast, but now because of freezers and trawlers and everything like that, you can get seafood absolutely everywhere. We all need to reduce our footprint. That's all there is to it. We absolutely have to, and we have to be much more mindful of what seafood we eat. Don't go for the long-lived, late-maturing species. And a lot of this information, you've got a lot of great information at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They have a seafood card, and there are various other organizations that actually have
something
really good guidance.
Something that kind of just popped off the top of my head as you were saying that.
Yes.
Do you think there's a way to integrate this sort of information at direct-to-consumer materials at the checkout? So, for example, being at the fish counter at that frozen aisle saying, these are the ages of the fish, these are their lifespans, this is where they're fished at, so that us as consumers have more direct information about the fish that we're purchasing and can make more educated choices.
So, yes, and that would be called traceability. And so going back to who caught your fish? How was it caught? Was it line caught? Was it net caught, etc.? So you're starting to see some of those measures being implemented, not everywhere. You do have organizations like the Marine Stewardship Council that are trying to certify certain fisheries as being sustainable, etc. It's a complex process. It's a very complex process. It's definitely not perfect, but it's definitely a lot of work in the right direction. And people are recognizing how incredibly important it is to really be a much more conscious and savvy consumer. And for those who are listening and who eat farm-caught fish, do know that, I mean, at this point, I think it's 54% of fish that are consumed are actually aquaculture-based fish or farm-raised fish, be they pens in the sea, etc. But it's very important for people to know that that is still placing a huge impact on marine ecosystems, because you have to feed those fish something. And if those are predatory fish, what we call piscivorous fish, aka fish that eat other fish, and that's usually what people like to eat, like snappers and groupers and cobia and such, then they need to be fed usually with food that will give them that taste. And where do they get that food? A lot of the time from other fish that are wild caught in the ocean. So what a lot of people don't realize is you're pulling the carpet out from wild fish by getting lower food chain fish to feed all of those farm-raised fish. So just bear that in mind, which is why I come back to just lower your footprint on seafood consumption. That would be one way of doing it. Lower consumption in general. Do we really need all the stuff that we have? Do we need to buy as much as we do? You know, buy experiences and be mindful when you buy experiences. If you travel and you're expecting to have X, Y, and Z seafood, and yet it's closed season, don't insist on having those species during closed season. I've been with high-level consultants who are like, but I want my lobster. And I'm telling them, I'm very sorry, but it's closed season. And they're like, yeah, but I promised my child that we would have lobster. I said, yes, but we've worked 20 years to have a closed season based on science. So please don't insist and don't try and get it from fishermen and make them break the law. So be a conscious consumer, be a conscious traveler. Lower your footprint. And then, of course, there are so many things that you can also do very actively to support. Find local organizations to support who are doing good work. You can find out a lot about so many organizations. I work in the tropical sphere. But, for example, in Britain, you have a wonderful fund called the Whitley Fund for Nature. They're amazing. I happen to be a recipient of one of their awards, but many partners I have across the world are recipients of the Whitley, and it's really promoting grassroots conservation. And
I hope to have them on soon.
Good. I'm really pleased. I'm really happy.
I hope to. Yep.
The Wildlife Conservation Network, they're fantastic. And if you're interested in sharks in Britain, you just couldn't do better than getting to know the Shark Trust in Plymouth. They're just fantastic. They do amazing work as well.
Yeah, there's amazing work being done in Plymouth here in the UK. I think we're coming up really close to our time here today. So I really want to know, what's the most important thing you want the listeners to take away from our chat here today?
So I think what I'm really excited about is that when we demonstrate that we give the sea a break, it's incredibly resilient and it will bounce back. And we've seen that firsthand during the pandemic, for example. Again, I'm going to give the example of Belize, where I'm a Belizean national. I'm very proud Belizean as well, and where I've done the majority of my work in marine. And we found that when there was no more fishing from our colleagues next door in Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico, when they could not come across the borders and people couldn't go out and fish these sharks and a range of other species, we started to see them bounce back. And we saw a huge bounce back in populations, again, that we determined through monitoring that we did with fishermen. So give them a break, lower your footprint, and support all of these people on the front line, the nurses and doctors of marine conservation. That is really how you can make a really big difference for ocean conservation.
Beautiful. I wish we could talk for so much. I've just got one extra question left for you here today. I would love to know what message of hope and encouragement you'd like to share with our listeners and where they can learn more about Mar Alliance, the work you do, and potentially get involved?
I would say, for somebody who's been working in this space for 30 years, I have a lot of hope. I see a huge change in attitudes and behavior in people. Of course, I work a lot with sharks. I've seen a massive change in attitude of people towards sharks, from being terribly, terribly afraid to now being curious and excited. And you see it on social media, where if anybody catches a shark or harms a shark, people are immediately really upset about that. Whereas before, they used to go, well done, you know, kill that animal or kill that fish. So that's the change in behavior. I'm seeing these shifts in consumer behavior as well, where people are not eating the more threatened species or lowering their seafood footprint. You're seeing more people actually go to the sea, connect with the sea, scuba dive, snorkel, surf, etc. And that is just wonderful, because they see firsthand the condition of the sea and how these habitats are changing even with climate change. But they are creating those essential connections with the sea. And what I would say, because as I'm always trying to pass the baton off to the next generation and to folks to care, is that there's so many ways that you can support, either through volunteering, and you don't have to be a marine biologist. You can be somebody who's like amazing at marketing or social media or writing, or really you love data. You're great at analyses. You're innovative in building structures that are needed for the science and so much more. So you can volunteer in that way. You can also, and that's what we say for Mar Alliance, you can also come and join us on some of our immersive expeditions, which are really amazing. They've been life-changing for many of the people who've come with us and spent a week with our team of traditional fishers and scientists, all local, and learning the techniques and hands-on and catching, tagging sharks, turtles, and more, and learning how the science is done. So many people want to be marine biologists but may not be able to afford to do so, or may have gone off into finance or advertising or law, etc. But they want to know what that was like or what that is like. So those are some of the ways in which you can support. And of course, we can really always use support financially, because it takes a lot to not only do the work that we're doing, but to scale as best as we can this approach to more communities, more sites, more countries, and more seas. So I am thankful for all of the folks who are very generously supporting us, and there's always so much more to do. And the easiest way to find out what we do, who we are, is come and join us on our website, maralliance.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and we've also moved to Blue Sky. So we're kickstarting in Blue Sky as well. And the best bit is, come and visit us in the sea. That's where we get to know you personally and we get to show you the work that we do. So
Thank you so much, Rachel. I've had the most wonderful chat with you today, learning all about Mar Alliance and the amazing work that you're doing. And thank you, everyone, today for listening to Our Altered World. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at flunkingmonkey, FLUNKINGMONKEY. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.